the New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.
Greetings and welcome along to the New Zealand Business Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Spain. Now, in this episode, we hear from one of New Zealand's most well-known business leaders, Sir Michael Hill. We go deep into Sir Michael's life story. It was actually pretty inspiring for me. There's some surprising bits in there too. And I'm sure at the end of it, you'll understand why he's been so successful. Now, before we kick into the chat with Sir Michael, just a little about me. I'm a commentator on business and technology topics across local and international media, including on radio and TV. My firm, Guerrilla Technology, offers IT services to small to medium New Zealand organisations. So we're the go-to place if you're that type of organisation. And I'm a keynote speaker recently, spending quite a lot of time focused on discussing digital disruption. All right, well, without further ado, let's jump straight in and talk with Sir Michael Hill. Well, greetings and welcome along to the podcast. Today, we're going to spend some time with Sir Michael Hill. Welcome along to the podcast, Sir Michael.
Hello, and very nice to be here.
Well, thanks for coming in. I hope it wasn't too much of a drama getting through that Auckland traffic today.
No. Well, the most hilarious thing is, of course, I tried to get into your building. You said it was on the second floor, so I went up the fire escape on the end of the building. I was banging on the door, and of course, literally nobody answered. I thought, I've got the wrong place.
Sorry about that. Well, maybe to start, we can hear a little bit about your journey, sort of starting out in life as a youngster, where you came from, what your family environment was like. What did your start in life look like?
Well, it's a very interesting thing. Well, I was born in Whangarei, an only child, and my father was an Electrolux salesman. He came north during the Depression to sell vacuum cleaners, Electrolux vacuum cleaners, and he played in a dance band as well. He was a bit of a character, I think, my dad. So when he came north and would knock on doors in Whangarei and did quite well selling vacuum cleaners, and he sold one to the Fishers, who owned the jewelry business there. And Hilda, my mother, he took a shine to her, and in fact he married her. So and I was the outcome of that. I was only child.
Yes.
And so I spent most of my life in Whangarei, and in fact yes, I did all my schooling there. I was through Whangarei Boys High School, which I hated, I might add, because I was bullied. My mother made me look too like a little Lord Fauntleroy. She dressed me too smartly, and I mean, they're all farming blokes there. They're not sort of, you know, you're not sort of smart in those days, certainly not. And so I really, I didn't enjoy school at all. In fact, it was pretty damn hard work, and I couldn't wait to get out of school, actually. And I left to be tried to become a violinist. There was a Danish music teacher who'd come to Whangarei. Whangarei was sort of one of those backwaters where people would come from, you know, all sorts of strange places. And he was a very capable violinist. And I started violin lessons, and I really loved playing the violin. And he said I had potential to become a violinist, a concert violinist. And I thought this sounded really great. So it was really probably the first, because my school marks were hideous at school. I really was an awful student. In fact, actually, I'll tell you a story about that. Jack Glanville, who was the maths teacher, when I was in the third form, he came over and saw my parents, and he told my parents in a heated argument, which I could hear through our state house. And he was telling them that I was the worst student of that year that had been at maths. I was his worst student in the whole school. And because of my lack of ability in that, and also my English was nearly as bad, that he said, without those two attributes, Michael will never amount to anything in life. And I just want to tell you, Billy, and it's which they called my wife, my mum, Billy, and Dick, my father, I want to tell you that Michael won't amount to anything much in life. Give him a trade. He's a timid boy, and don't push him too much. So that was sort of the advice that sort of was given to my parents. And my mum was in tears after that. And in fact, actually, it did really actually make quite a profound difference on me, because what with the bullying at school, which is why I couldn't think, because, I mean, I couldn't concentrate because I knew I was going to be, you know, pestered again in the lunch break or whatever it was. It mucked me up quite a bit. So I was pleased to get out of school, and I practiced. I went and stayed with this Åge Nielsen was this guy's name, this violin guy. And I went twice a week for lessons. I practiced 8 hours a day. And over 18 months, I got pretty good. In fact, they had a violin competition there in Auckland in those days. The Herald, New Zealand Herald, had a violin competition. I entered, and I came fourth. When I came back to Whangarei after that, my uncle wanted to see me, who owned the jewellery business that my mum and dad both were working in by that stage. And he said that, "You've been wasting your parents' time, haven't you, son?" He called me son. He didn't like me either, which is strange. "Son, you've been fiddling around, just wasting your parents' time, wasting everybody's time. You're a pain. I want you to come down tomorrow. I'm going to make a watchmaker out of you, son. I want you there at 8 o'clock sharp." And that's actually how I started my career in the jewellery business, being a watchmaker at Fisher's the Jewellers in Whangarei. And in those days, watchmaking was an enormous part of the business, because everything was mechanical. There was from cuckoo clocks to chiming clocks to Big Ben alarm clocks to wristwatches, and they were always breaking down. So a shop like Fisher's had 7 watchmakers in it. Today you don't find a watchmaker basically in a shop, which is quite a difference. So I lasted 3 months at that. And
did he speak to you the same way again after the 3 months? It was a bit of a different way of operating, wasn't it?
Michael's not doing too well at anything. So Norman Wright said he's breaking too many alarm clocks. We can't have him going to mend watches. It's just not going to work. So there was another heated argument, and they decided, well, there's only one thing for him. He'll have to become a shop assistant. Now, I thought this was the most hideous affliction you could put on me to make me a shop assistant. And my dad had joined the business and wasn't selling Electrolux, and he was managing the shop, and my uncle was out the back doing the books. So there I was. And
how old were you at this stage?
At that stage, I had turned 18. But the silly part about it is I quite enjoyed it. And my dad knew selling backwards. In fact, he was a brilliant salesperson. And he would analyze every sale. And we've used a lot of his techniques still today in Michael Hill, in our jewelry business. And So I stayed in that, and I learned from him, and then I started dressing the windows. And the windows in those days had everything. About 75% of the shop would be in the window, and you'd have your diamond rings and your trophy cups and your Ladro figures and Dresden figures and all the bits and pieces are all there. So people would make a choice mainly in the window and then come in and ask to see an item in the window. So I started taking some of the shelves out and simplifying the window displays and doing some bizarre window displays. And in fact, I even got to the women's weekly, which was actually part of the Herald then, and was had a pink cover. And they photographed me, my windows, which I was putting diamond rings in drain pipes, which probably no one had ever done before.
I
had a flair, an artistic flair, which worked quite well there. And in 1969, I entered the Bulova International Window Dressing Competition, which was when the first electronic watch had come out, the Bulova Accuton. And I did a window with a violin and a sheet of music, and as you'd imagine, and a tuning fork, and sent this off to Switzerland. And then my uncle, about 2 months later, got a phone call in the middle of the night to say I'd won the competition for the world. And that was probably the first break that I'd ever had, really. It was the first change in you know, that. And at this stage, I'd met my wife, who'd come from Huddersfield on an immigration to teach art in Whangarei Girls High School. And we just had Mark, our son. And so for 3 months, and we shot off on a world trip. And that's when I saw the Hong Kong gold markets and the Singapore gold markets, and it tweaked me that I thought this would be a great way for a shop to look. Then I saw Switzerland, and I saw all the beautiful, simple windows in Switzerland, and I thought if I could marry those simple windows and put the U-shape of counters, that would make an amazing thing. But the thing is, I knew I couldn't do it because everyone had told me I couldn't do it, and that was built into me. That fear of doing or going out by myself was too strong.
Wow.
So I couldn't do it. So I stayed with my uncle in that business for 23 years. 23 years.
Wow. I would have never guessed that you stayed at that 23 years, considering the success that you have today, which is on a pretty impressive scale. So what was it that allowed you to let go of that fear and sort of break through and really become, I guess, who you were made to be?
Well, it's the most remarkable thing, really. And it's quite by freak chance. There was a Claude Megson, who was a gifted architect, who's still created currently in Auckland University when they're doing architecture. He is the god of architecture because his drawings and the way that everything flowed was so beautiful. And we engaged him to build us a home on the Whangarei Harbour. I'd found a piece of land which no one thought you could put a drive up, but we got a drive up, and it was beautiful. It overlooked the harbour, and it was all full of kauai trees and huge totara trees. And Claude designed a beautiful house that floated all in amongst these in a hexagonal pattern that he said would take 9 months to build. It was 3 stories high. It was all clad in cedar and beautiful double-filled cavity concrete blocks. A masterpiece, really. But it took 2 years to build. We ran out of money. We finished off a lot of things ourselves, but we completed it. And we were going to the pictures one night because I was just finishing off with black enamel a bookcase that opened, and behind it was all the stereo gear. The day was raining, and Christine said, "You're getting cross, let's go to the pictures." So we dropped the children off at Christine's parents, and we went to the cinema, the Regent Theatre in Whangarei. And then when we went back to pick up the children from Christine's parents' place at Onorahi, the phone rang. It was Mrs. Strongman, who lived along the road from where we were. And agitated, she said, "I don't know how to tell you this, Mrs. Hill, but your house is on fire." And that was the night that changed my life. So we got in Christine's Mini and we shot out to Waikarek, and as we round the corner on the big bay, up in the bush, and I can still see it, the flames were licking about 60 foot in the sky, and all the cedar was just, the whole thing was just an explosion of flames, and the drive was very steep and the fire engine got stuck on a corner, and they were trying to manhandle up the pumps, and it was all too late. So we watched it burn.
Wow.
And all I took out of it was the violin that I had. I ran in and got a violin out and some of Christine's jewelry, and we had nothing except what we stood on that night, and that was it. And that night, I wrote on a piece of paper, "I'm going to own my uncle's business," because I'd never had the guts to stand up to him because he's a bully. Mm. "I'm going to own it, and if he doesn't sell, I'm going to start by myself." Now, what a crazy time to have a dream, because suddenly I have no money. I was underinsured, had nothing on the contents. I've lost my home. I didn't lose the children. I didn't leave my wife, thank God, but I had nothing. But I wrote it down, and the writing down was the thing. I wrote it down on a piece of paper that I was going to do that. And within 9 months, I'd found a backer who I played the violin with, Nigel and Evie Knight, who had inherited a lot of money from England. And I wooed Nigel into putting up the money to have a bid to buy my uncle's business. But I probably knew it underneath it all, because we made an offer and my uncle refused. But we went back again, made a very big offer, which the accountant said is foolish, it's far too much. And we thought we had it, but my uncle still turned it down. And he left me with no other option but to go and start my own jewelry business five doors down. 30-foot front was on the big Fishers, the jewelers, and about 3,000 square feet. I started with a 15-foot front with 680 square feet, with a roller door on the front, like you see in Hong Kong, with a simple Swiss windows, were changed every week, very simple, and selling diamond rings basically on the street. And with 18 months, we're taking more than that business that had been there for 55 years.
Wow.
We creamed it.
Wow.
I did radio. I'd go down to the radio station each week. I'd voice my own commercials. I took page three, right-hand page of the Northern Advocate each week. Christine Hand drew the catalogues. And then we went on TV. And then within 5 years, with one TV station, suddenly everyone knew me. It was amazing. So we had nine shops then, and then with nine shops, my backer was starting to get a bit fidgety. He loved it, but Evie was not seeing him anymore, and he thought, "Yeah, this is not what I expected from you, Nigel." So I had a feeling it was going to be a friction. So I went up to the ANZ Bank in Bank Street, Whangarei, took a big loan and paid Nigel out and paid them out and owned it 100%. But it strapped me for cash, and I can still hear my uncle, because my uncle was furious when I left. He said, "I'm going to crush the bastard in 3 months." He made it very difficult for me. I owe a lot to my uncle, because if people make it tough for you, it makes you stronger. And it was that pushed me to float the company, to become public. And we went public and to have a crack at Australia. So it was a hell of a time, and now we've got 187 shops in Australia, and we've got 55 here, and the rest is in North America, where we started nearly 15 years ago now, and in Canada. And the good news about Canada is that in a new market, it's very hard to make a stance, because nobody knew us.
No.
Emma, my daughter, went up there. Emma was chosen by her peers to go up to Canada. And we did everything. We did the same look of the shop. We had the shops looked the same as they did down here. We would open with an opening specials, and red hot specials, and the shop looked spick and span. We had great staff. A lot of staff had come from Australasia for the first two shops we had, which was in Vancouver. And but Emma rang me on the phone. I said, "How did it go?" Expecting it to take about some big money. Says, "Dad, I can't close. They won't. They're coming in, but I cannot close. They won't buy. Emma was in tears. I thought, "God, this is not very good." Anyhow, it's surprising, but 7 years we lost money there, and then we just kept persevering. But now it's a very interesting graph, actually, because the graph was just sort of flat, just nothing, absolutely nothing. But about just over 18 months ago, it started to turn. And last year, we're into profit and going up. And this year's going to go up. And we've got 78 shops now. And at 85, we'll be the number one jeweler in Canada. How's that?
Wow.
For a Kiwi boy.
Wow. So you've been through some tough stuff. I mean, for all involved, not just you.
Yeah.
But
I know.
As you've gone into a situation like that, and maybe there'll be some other stories you can tell us, but that one there, that really, it takes some grit. It takes, I guess you've got to have a lot of belief that you're ultimately going to pull through. And of course, not every situation is actually going to go your way. But obviously, in that case, What was it that kept on going with that?
Well, the thing is, I'd always believed in goal setting. I'd always tried to goal set. I'd done all the things you were supposed to do, but there was always that block, that fear, because of I suppose right from Jack Glanville saying that to all those non-successes, that I had a fear. And a lot of people I found have that same fear, that they're scared of change. And I was the same. But the house fire, the moment that it for some reason, it just cleared my mind instantly. I just knew there was no doubt about what I had to do. There was no doubt. It was like flicking a switch. And I just knew what I had to do. And there was nothing to stop me doing it. Right or wrong, I had to do it. I had to be committed. And, yeah, it was just one of those weird things. Now, the interesting thing is that if it had not been the house fire, would I still be in Whangarei? I probably would be. We said Whangarei. We didn't say Whangarei in those days. But would I have still been there? I guess eventually I would have acquired my uncle's jewellery business. He probably would have sold that. And I might have bought a bigger piece of land or something. I don't know. But would I still be there? Wouldn't it be interesting to know? Never know that one.
parallel stories. So with the other challenges, I mean, maybe you can tell us about getting into shoes, because that was along the way you have these different things, and obviously you've been incredibly successful in terms of your growth into Australia, Canada, you're in the US as well. But not everything goes your way. So how did you make that call to try going into shoes, and then how did you make the call to get out?
Yes, well, strange enough, it actually wasn't really my idea. The board, or a majority of the board, saw an opportunity from a guy in Christchurch who had three very successful shoe shops. And I thought that would be a good thing to do. So we went along with that. But we didn't really follow.
So was that an acquisition to start with?
It was an acquisition.
Yeah.
Chap Shaw. But it wasn't actually, we didn't actually follow his model. We made them more like a Michael Hill. So it was really selling shoes a different way. And it was an industry which, I mean, I didn't really know much about. And they said, "Will you go on and voice the commercials?" So, I mean, here's me doing. We used to go up to Toowoomba and up out of Brisbane there. I'd drive up there with Christine. She'd make a packed lunch. We'd go up there for the day. And I'd do all these ruddy commercials. I'd be doing commercials for Hello, Michael Hill Jeweler. Next thing I'm doing, Hello, Michael Hill Shoes. That's right. Put yourself in Michael's shoes. I mean, how hideous was that, for God's sake? It started to confuse things a bit. It also confused my general manager in New Zealand, because he was sidetracked. He wasn't just concentrating on the jewellery business. He was more interested in getting the shoe business going. So we had seven shops in pretty quick succession, and we were losing money big time. And I just woke up one night and I just said, this has got to stop. We've got to get back to the keeping it simple. And that was the one big lesson we learned from that. If you're doing something well, or you're good at something, don't deviate too much. Keep it simple. Complexity is a big problem today in business. I'd like to talk a bit more about that later. But yeah, so that's how we got in and out of shoes quite rapidly. And the big difference for the jewellery business and the shoe business is that shoes, of course, come in different sizes. So in jewellery business, one size fits all, and we can alter the ring to fit any finger. So, but in the shoe business, of course, as you know, it's you can be landed with, you know, too small, too big, too thin. God knows what. It's quite a complex business. And yes, it certainly wasn't for us. I'm so pleased we moved out as quickly as we did.
That's great. Now tell me about these complexities in business.
Okay, complexity. Well, as you get bigger and as the business gets bigger, I mean, when it was in my day, I mean, you know, there was just a few of us, so we could make a decision like right now. You and I could make a deal on something and we'd do it and it'd be implemented next week. But today, you know, when you've got, you know, nearly 3,000 people in there, it has to go through all the systems, and the systems can complicate things. So complication become quite a thing. And everybody, a lot of people try to justify their positions by making things even more complex. So complexity is really our enemy. And to be successful in business, you need to hover above the micromanagement and the complexity and see the big picture. And as we get larger, you know, our top executives, we all need to be able to not be concentrating on minute little details. It's the big picture that needs looking at it on a big perspective. So,
how did you get from being somebody that was so focused on the detail and designing these windows that were obviously the best in the world from the recognition that you got there from the day-to-day selling.
Yeah.
How did you manage to make that transition? Was there a point in time you realized you had to do something differently, or was it something that actually quite naturally came as the business grew?
It came quite naturally, strange enough, because I've always realized I'm not very good at most things. So I need to surround myself with people that were better than myself. And if I got the people that were really, really good at doing things, you know, and I found the best, they're going to prop me up an awful lot. So I've always liked people. I've liked to empower people, and I like to let them fly. I don't like stepping on and interfering with that person once they're on their own journey. Once they've been trained up, so I think that's probably the way I've done it is to empower people. And a lot of people say to me, well, how do you find people you can trust? I mean, how can you trust these people to do what you're doing with them? But you have to. You have to have faith in people, and you have to find people. And strangely enough, you can find people that people overlook. I find a lot of people that other people think are absolutely, they'll say, well, why would you employ them? But sometimes if you find a person that's got a real spark and a sparkle in the eye, and you can tell they're enthusiastic about doing something, well, you can turn those people into something pretty special. And that gives me an enormous thrill. A lot of the people that have been in our business, I mean, we're just appointing a new CEO today. And that man has been with us, since for 30-odd years. It's incredible. So we've turned, you know, some people into some amazing positions.
That's fantastic, isn't it? I mean, it's very satisfying being able to create an opportunity where people can flourish and just, you know, be themselves in an environment with the right support and the right things around them. Have you found that there are particular ways that you achieve that for yourself, for other people, in terms of courses and outside things, or is it all internal?
Yes, it's a combination of all of those things. The thing is to make sure the training is solid first, so that they well understand the model, and then when they're ready. It's like the bird, isn't it? Out of Cape Kidnappers, you know, you see these albatrosses and these gannets, you know, and they sort of they're on the edge there, and they dare not flap there, but the mother's sort of pushing with her beak, and then and it's away.
Yeah.
And you've got to let people go. You've got to let them flourish, and they can surprise you, really. So the answer is, but you don't just let them go and then turn your back on them. You have to watching and critiquing them, but praising them, encouraging them, and give them, as you say, extra courses and experience other businesses, so that they understand the enormity of what we're doing. Because our company is a $500 million company, but we want to take it within about 5 years to $1 billion. So we're on a very ambitious project at the moment, and we've spent a long time getting this thing ready to launch globally. And it's going to be very exciting. The next few years are going to be the most exciting in our business history. I'm quite sure of that.
That's very exciting. Now, tell me a little bit about succession planning, because particularly within our smaller businesses in New Zealand, but it's not exclusive to that. When you look around the world at lots of businesses, often succession planning isn't something that maybe yields the right results. Maybe there just isn't any planning done. But you've done very well at bringing people in to be able to lead and run the business. It doesn't appear as though you have too much to worry about in terms of the day-to-day running and general leadership. You mentioned appointing a new CEO. How have you managed that?
Well, we've looked at that very seriously and taken that very seriously. And in fact, is probably the reason... why I'm so enthusiastic about moving forward. I'm very lucky to have two children that are quite different. I mean, Mark is extremely artistic, like Christine, my wife, who was an art teacher, and he's a sculptor. And Emma's got all my abilities plus 10 times more, really. So we've got an interesting combination. But the thing is that they want to carry the business to carry on. So this is something that we needed to discover. And therefore, we have the opportunity of making a global brand, because all global brands have a base and a core of a family and a structure. It's just not a name you make. Michael Hill's not a name you just make up. It's a proper sound foundation, and Emma is now of course is chair of the board. We've got a great board, amazing board, an incredible board actually. Rob Fife, who was Air New Zealand, now icebreaker, is quite a. Quite an exceptional man. We've got Janine Ellis, who is who has a Boost Juice in Australia, a self-made lady. She's on that Shark Tank, I think, over there. And then we've got Gary Smith, who's the chair of the Flight Centre board, who's got an exceptional group now of minds and thinking. And but succession now is something that's definitely going to happen with us in the business. Now, quite frankly, had neither of my children showed no interest in that, I probably would have sold out by now. I think I would have, because what would be the point of carrying on something that's got no future? So, but I can see it now, and it's really exciting for me and very exciting for them. And something we do as a family is that three times a year we have a proper formal meeting. So there's Mark Hill and Monica, his wife, and then there's Emma, and there's Christine and myself, and then we have our accountant, and we have our tax lawyer, and we have it's got a proper agenda, and we have like 2/3 of a day, and everyone discusses everybody's own personal issues, and then the big issues. And that we've been doing that now for 10 years. And that, I think, was the grounding that made all this possible. See, I see a lot of people that don't really speak too much to their children. Well, they do, but they may leave them the money in the will or something. And then one day I go and they're left with this money, but there's no organization of what happens with it all. And that to me is a pity, because I think if a family works as a pack and a team,
yes,
then it becomes a very powerful force. So I'm very excited about it anyhow. And everyone is very excited to take this company to the next stage. Emma can't leave it alone. I mean, Emma can hardly sleep at night. She's thinking of all these ideas, and it's extremely exciting.
That's fantastic. Now, the mention of family, certainly when we look at a lot of founders, myself included, the managing of business and family life and making those things fit together isn't always the easiest thing. But you seem to have done incredibly well in those regards. You've got a great family. You seem to have had a very strong, solid marriage. How have you managed that?
Well, I think a lot of it is causing a bit of, I've always tried to form a balance in what I do. And I think it's very important to be successful. You need to have time. You need to have time by yourself. I do meditation, actually.
Yeah.
And it's surprising, really, that your best time comes sometimes when you're not at work, or when you're completely relaxed, or in my case, I can do meditation, and in 20 minutes, and not always, but occasionally, it becomes a time when you think, oh my God, and something becomes so clear and focused. Because what meditation does, of course, is that it occasionally one goes into a state of what they call pure consciousness, is where everything is still. And in that stillness is where you've got all your infinite wisdom and all your, you know, all your genes and everything is all combined with that. And then when you come out of that state, if there's something that's in your subconscious, it'll come straight to you like a dart, and it can be enormously beneficial. It's also very calming. It's very relaxing, and it takes stress away. And the family, we spend a lot of time together. I mean, my best friends are Mark and Emma, and then we socialize together. We have meals together, and we have a lot of respect for each other. No one, everyone is very respectful of us all there. But on the same hand, also, you know, they'll tell you, I mean, if any of us are doing something that looks a bit odd, you know, they'll have a go at me, don't worry. And I'll listen, because, you know, you must already... One of the worst things in life is to think that you're so smart that no one can tell you anything. I think being humble is probably something that I think is the most wonderful thing to have, is to be humble in life and treat everyone as equal.
That's great advice. Now, you've had a board for, you know, quite some time.
We did.
At what point did you appoint a board? And what have been the pros and cons of having that board? Obviously, there's a time where you have to have a board when you're listed and so on.
Well, you do. And I think a listing as a company, if I had my choice again, I'd do exactly the same thing. I would list again. I think it was a very good idea. It raised capital. It gave us a lot of capital, which we desperately needed. It also, every year, you know, you have to look after the shares. So you have to be thinking, you know, that, good Lord, we are a public company. So everything you do has to be, you know, you have to make sure everything's absolutely right and correct and the whole thing. So I think it's a very good discipline, and I really enjoyed that. As for the first board I have, I don't think it was very good at all. And I don't think some of those people on were particularly helpful. But in the very first place, they were, and it got us going, and that's really great. Yeah, I don't know if I can say much more about that. Yeah, that's it.
But I guess it's important to have a great board as you have now, and one that really understands what its role is.
I think the thing is that with boards, is when you know you've got a really great one, when no one's got an ego, no one just speaks for the sake of speaking, because a lot of people like the sound of their voice, but, you know, and everyone's very respectful, but everyone is also adding an enormous amount of ideas that the energy levels are truly incredible, really. We are very lucky to have the people we've got at the moment. I could not be happier, it really is. And it's helping Emma an enormous amount as well, an enormous amount, yes. And me. Yes, I'm learning so much.
That's great. Well, you do. You learn from those people you surround yourself with, don't you? And
yes.
Being able to have those people is great.
Yep.
Now... I know we have to finish up shortly.
Yeah.
I'm just keen to understand, you know, you've got some passions that are outside of the core business things.
Yeah.
Obviously the violin side, you're golfing and your course. Tell us a little bit about those and how you've managed to fit those in while still growing such an incredible business.
Well, I mean, I always wanted to play the violin. Well, I still do play the violin. I have a beautiful violin. I have a Guadagnini, which was made in 1750, which is hard to believe, really, because goodness me, go back 1750 in New Zealand, you know, Auckland was pretty wild place. So I always wanted to give back, and I thought there would be nothing more wonderful to have a violin competition. So we have the Michael Hill International Violin Competition. And there was a lovely lady, Anne Rodder, who managed the Auckland Philharmonia, who came and managed this competition for me. And we're having it again in June in this year. So Queen's Birthday in Queenstown. We have 16 of the world's greatest violinists that have been chosen from about 150 that all puts they send videos of themselves playing, and they're all judged by a panel of top violinists from all the orchestras in Australasia.
Great.
They come out here, and then we have 7 world-class adjudicators, seriously hot violinists, will judge which of these 16 becomes the winner of the competition. So it goes through 3 rounds. The first rounds, they play 2 rounds in Queenstown, and they love it down there. They billeted it out, and it's a beautiful surroundings, and it's nice for making great music. It's in a little simple memorial hall, but they love it. We make them feel part of the family, so, which is unusual in competitions. So we share everything with them, and they think that's absolutely amazing. Then it's down to 6. They come to Auckland and they play a Mozart around here in the chamber, Auckland Chamber Music Hall. And then 3 are chosen, and then the finals, I think, are on the 15th of June. And they have to play a concerto by heart, one of their choice there. And then we have a winner. But it's the most amazing thing. And it's just the discipline those people show, and they're it's truly incredible. The standard of violin playing and piano playing, well, anything now, is just getting higher and higher. So we'll have people from Japan, we'll have them from Korea, we'll have them from Spain, we'll have them from England, we'll have them from the United States. They're all over the place, and Vienna, there's all people coming from everywhere. So it'll be the most amazing experience for me. That's and then great. The golf. Well, I've run the golf now for the New Zealand Open for 7 years, so that's been and they're at this year, they're just the courses and beautiful, the hills, our course, and it's at Millbrook and at Hills this year, and so that starts on Thursday. So and that'll be television is now right through, it'll be most of the world this time, so it's pretty good. So that's going really well, but the hills is looking superb. The golf course is looking in amazing condition. I've got, you know, it's all about people. I've got a great team running that. It's just amazing.
And that's really the key, isn't it? It's
We're very lucky living in New Zealand. I mean, I can't believe I bought a farm, a 500-acre farm there in the early 90s, and to think it's my land and I've got a golf course, I can't believe it's me. Really, I have to pinch myself. But, you know, when you fly into Queenstown, you just see this amazing valley, really. But we're very lucky to live in New Zealand and in Australia. Australasian, we are very lucky, lovely part of the world. And all of us have an opportunity here because it's not that big. And we don't have a class system, so to speak, like they do in other places where, you know, it's your position, you cannot do that. Anyone can rise up if they really, you know, if they have a spark of something there that they want to achieve. It's right. And the big secret is whatever you want to do, you got to write it down. You have to get a piece of paper, A4 paper, and write down what you want to be and what you want to be in 30 years' time. That's what I want to hear. Seal the envelope up, put it under the bed or somewhere safe, look at it in the year's time, review it, then put it back again and start on your journey. And that's the way it happened with me in the end. I had to write it down.
That's great. So that's your challenge to all of our listeners.
Yes.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you very much for your time, Sir Michael. It's been a real pleasure and honour to be able to spend this time with you and to hear some of your stories and to learn from you.
Yeah, no, it's been one hell of a life, I tell you. And the best is yet to come, I think.
Fantastic. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, all the best.
Cheers. Well, I trust you really enjoyed hearing Sir Michael Hill's story. And I hope you took to heart his recommendation to be writing down your goals. After we finished talking, he reiterated to me again the importance of just, you know, stop what you're doing, get written down where you want to be. Take that action, even if you don't have the full picture, but just start with writing down where you want to head and where you think you would be in 30 years' time. But lots of great things to glean from that chat with Sir Michael Hill. So I really hope that you got some good takeaways from that. Now, if you'd like to stay up to date about new episodes of the New Zealand Business Podcast and the other content I produce, then you can feel free to sign up for my email updates at paulspain.com. And if you want to get in touch, feel free to email me directly, paul@spain.nz. Well, thanks for listening to the New Zealand Business Podcast. We'll be back again with another episode next week.
The New Zealand Business Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, your strategic and proactive IT partner.